Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. She's the infidel your imam warned you about, and there's no holding her back as she shares her opinions, insights, information, and outrage discussing the political entity known as Islam. We are at a critical juncture in our history, and if the threat of Islam is not faced up front, right now, then we will lose the freedoms of individuality, civic justice, and autonomy of thought we rightly enjoy, and instead see our values replaced with kinetic and civilizational jihad, Sharia law, and oppression permanently. Don't let the memory of our soldiers, past and present, go in vain. It is up to us to protect the legacy for which they fought so hard. We have an obligation to honor their memory today and for future generations. Join Kel Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Blog Talk Radio. But leave your political correctness well away from her phone lines and chat room. And be warned, Kel takes no prisoners.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Changes.
We are justified in doing anything we can to survive.
And that is so true. And hey, everybody, welcome to the program. You are listening to the Red Fox Blogger. I am your host, Kel Fritzy, where I fly solo on Friday evenings, well, at least for the first hour and 15 minutes. And Michael Green joins me for a report from the Middle East in the second hour. I have some wonderful people filing in already. I want to thank you all. I can't type with one hand. Well, I can, but it's awkward. But Bigfoot Jeff of the English Defense League, I've got some guests moving forward. Smoky Southern Sense, and that's my Annie and Vorpal by Hey, Vorp, stick around, baby. I have your song, okay? And, well, me and Vorp, we're going to get a little naughty with the musical break. A little later. But just to let you know that, oh, and Diane is here too. Prepper D. Hi, baby. Just to let you know, give you an update about Tim Burton. As you know, he is my Monday co-host, my Tuesday co-host, and he's part of a panel on Thursday. He was taken back into hospital earlier today. And he's doing all right, but he had more chest pains going on there. And so he had to go, you know, through the whole rigmarole again and get checked out and this and that and the other thing. He was hooked up to all sorts of weird things. I had been speaking with Mrs. Tim all afternoon, and I was actually speaking with Mrs. Tim off and on when I was doing other things, but I was not far away from the computer. And Jeff, yeah, you're right. More stents are probably due, and so we don't know exactly what is situation is going to be, but he is resting comfortably. They're just waiting for him to receive his papers so that he and Mrs. Tim can go home. It's been a long day for them. But he is my co-host, and it's hard. So, don't know when he'll be back on the air with us. Could be a while, not too sure, but I think that he'll be all right, but he's going to be extremely limited to what he can do on the air for the next little while. And if he goes in for more stents, well, that means more bed rest, which means I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff solo around here. So, but you know what? I ain't being selfish about it. I am saying to you, please think of Tim and his family and Mrs. Tim, who is just been so wonderful about informing us on his condition. Like I say, he is doing well, but he will be missed on the air. He can't do full two-hour shows at this point, and he certainly cannot do the EDL, not the EDL, the Radio G-Head Network show. No, the man who does the EDL radio show the best, of course, is Jeff Mitchell. But no, he won't be doing the 6 p.m. shows Eastern Time for quite a while. It's too late for him. That's 11 p.m. his time. And under the circumstances, I would never, ever, ever expect him to do something like that. But like I say, I thank you all for thinking about him and his wife and his family and for me, because it's really hard when you have somebody that you love and care about, and because they are your compatriots in the counter-jihad movement. And I remember when Jeff became ill a couple of years back, that was hell on wheels for me too. So I take this very personally. I do love all these people. I absolutely do, because they're my family. They're my BTR family, and they look out for me as well. So that's the latest. And, well, as an aside, my dog continues to do well. My cat continues to hide in the pantry. It's like, hang on a sec.
Supper. Come on.
That's kind of like what it's like around here. But we do have a lot going on. And I do have a lot of issues that I want to get through. And it is wonderful to have you all here. I do have a very special caller that's going to be joining me in a moment. You notice the show highlights, okay? Aisha and the Middle East. And this is actually inspired by a question that Bigfoot asked in a chat room last night. And I was at, trying to think of the show. You guys, I'm surprised if I remember my middle name sometimes. But Bigfoot asked a really good question pertaining to Aisha. And so I found some information about her. As you know, this was Muhammad's third wife, his favorite wife. And I did not realize that she was so involved in the war for jihad. And Bigfoot, yes, it was Islam exposed. Thank you, Bigfoot. I did not realize that she was quite the jihadist. So we're going to be discussing that. But I do have somebody on the line, and I want to bring them in right now. Oh, he dropped out. Move in. Please call back in. Oh, yeah. Jeff from EDR Radio. Yes, he just put in the chat room there and to remind us that... there was an elderly woman, 82 years old, who was beheaded in the UK, yeah. And this guy was apparently a Muslim convert. I might want to touch upon that a little later on. I have the article, so Jeff, thank you for reminding me about that. We are not too sure of the circumstances behind that, so I don't want to speculate, but he was... looking for cats. Apparently, we don't know if this guy is just out and out insane or what's going on with this nut job, but he was looking for a cat that apparently stole his lighter. Make of that what you will. And so he was thrashing about backyards. He was he had a machete, a foot-long machete. He was thrashing about slaughtering rose gardens, looking for this cat that stole his lighter. I guess people complained, and the casualty was this elderly woman. She was, like Jeff said, 82 years old, and she was in her backyard. And they found her slumped in her sun chair. It's a very, very, very odd world out there, people. It's a very dangerous world, it seems, these days. This guy running around, it was hell on wheels. But I do have my very special caller with me. And hello, 8636. How are you tonight?
Oh, hello, hello, Kel. This is Wahabi here from the Sponges, and I hope you can hear me on the alternate communication device I have here. Do I sound okay to you? Good night.
You sound very, very good. You sound like you're right underneath my desk, hopefully not with a machete.
Good for you, Friday, Wolf Lady. I am here. I just left Bosnia. I am in Croatia. I had new wife in the Bosnia, two new wives in Croatia, having big party, big party before I go back to Bosnia. I talked maybe to you last week, something that that was big plan after Guantanamo vacation.
But you had a beautiful time. If you were languishing in Guantanamo, it was beautiful. You had everything you could possibly ask for. Has $7 million soccer fields, arrows on the floor pointing the way towards Mecca, little hammocks for the Quran being handled literally with kid gloves by the guardians. Oh, my goodness. If I was a detainee in Gitmo, believe me, I would never want to leave.
That's right. Spongistan. We are sponges from you, and you stand for it, and we love you. So I am still here, Wahabi here, giving you news, update. My marriage to three new wives headed back to Spongistan. But I have to say that I am... Kel, are you wearing your headscarf tonight, talking to me, Wahabi?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good for you. Good for you, dude. You remember the sex agreement with your show. That's very good. So I give you news that I gave news on almost United Kingdom EBL show earlier today that we will open the ammonium nitrate plant in Crimea under Qatar and Chechen business agreement with Ukraine and Crimea. That is big news because you will have
You must be pleased with that. You must be very pleased with that. That's quite a coalition.
Yes, good business, good news, good for us and good for you.
Ah, that's
so
more
that
than people are going
to understand. if your questions, I will answer your questions, please.
I want to ask you. You mentioned your third wife, but you're allowed to have four wives. What happened to the fourth wife? I thought you had four.
No, we talked about this before, Gail. I see you have been drinking the Johnny's Walking Liquor in Canada from formerly United Kingdom produce, but we can have six wives in Spongistan. Six wives and 12 yaks. It's average... for men in Spongistan. So you asked question, what happened to fourth wife? I told you that she went to beauty parlor, haram practice, did not agree with my liking and practices. So I told you I lost all my wives and had to go to Bosnia and other nearby places for new ones. So now I have three. And that is update from me, Wahabi.
I understand that.
Yes.
Hey, I do have another question for you. I have another question for you. I understand that the yak dollar made it to the New York exchange, and so I invested stock in Spongistan, and I lost a lot of money. How do you rectify that, and how do I get my money back?
Oh, you must have been talking to terrible Tim Burton about the yacht exchange. I told him that if he went to Spongistan to exchange dollars, monetary euros for yacht exchange, he would be okay. But he chose to use exchange funded by David Chameleon there in the United Kingdom.
Okay, so essentially what I'm not going to do anymore is invest in the Middle East altogether because doing that only contributes to your sponging off us, and, of course, we stand for that.
Well, Kel, thank you for taking report here from Spongistan. please put me on the purge button, and I will continue to broadcast your terrible show to a wedding party here for my third wife.
Wahabi, I want to thank you so very much. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. And ladies and gentlemen, that was Wahabi from Spongistan, where they sponge off of us and we stand for it, but all the same. Believe me, you never know what you're going to get. Life is like a box of chocolates. You just never know what you're going to open up next. But, yeah. Oh, Wahabi, you made my day. Thank you also very much for your prayers for Tim and his family. And like I say, he's going to be fine. Of course he will be. I want to move into this topic, though, because unbelievably, we're already into the 21-minute mark. Aisha. Now, who was Aisha? Let's share who she was. She was born in 614, and she died in 678. She was the third and favorite wife of Muhammad and daughter of the Caliph Abu Bakr. Now, after the Prophet's death in 632, she opposed the fourth caliph, Ali. When her army was defeated by him in the Battle of the Camel in 656, she retired to Medina. But what is who was Aisha? We know that this was a marriage of convenience. We have figured that one out. But Aisha, or Aisha, 614 to 78, as aforementioned, was the favorite wife of the Prophet Muhammad, the false prophet people. And after the death of his first wife, Khadija, he married her. In order to strengthen ties with Abu Bakr, his chief advisor, Muhammad married Aisha, Abu Bakr's daughter, when she was about 9 years old. Well, he was 53 at the time, and he married her when she was 6. They consummated the marriage when she was 9. Now, even after subsequent marriages of the Prophet, she remained devoted to him. She is known among Muslims as Mother of the Believers. After the death of Muhammad in 632, Aisha, a childless widow of 18, helped her father become the first caliph or ruler of the Muslims. She remained politically inactive during his caliphate, and that went from 632 to 634. But she later opposed the succession of Ali as the fourth caliph, who reigned from 656 to 661, and incited an unsuccessful revolt against him. Her full name is Aisha bint Abu Bakr. And most common spelling, of course, is A-I-S-H-A. It can be translated many ways. In Islamic writings, like I say, she's the mother of the believers. She's a very controversial figure, though, because of differing portrayals of her in Shia versions of Islamic history and her role in the first fitna, and that would be the first Islamic civil war, at the head of an army against Ali bin Abu Talib in the Battle of Basra. Quite the character this one was. Being the daughter of Roman and Abu Bakr of Mecca, now Abu Bakr belonged to the Banu Taim subclan of the tribe of Qurayshah, the tribe of which Muhammad also belonged. Aisha is said to have followed her father in accepting Islam when she was still young. She also joined him in his first migration to Abyssinia, or Ethiopia, in 615 AD. A number of Mecca's Muslims emigrated then, seeking refuge from persecution by the Meccans who still followed their pro-Islamic religions. Now, according to early Islamic historian Muhammad ibn Jar al-Tabari, Aisha's father tried to spare her the dangers and discomfort of the journey by solemnizing her marriage to her fiancé, Jabir ibn Mutrim, son of Mutatim bin Abdi. However, Muta refused to honor the long-standing betrothal as he did not wish his family to be connected to the Muslim outcasts. The emigration to Ethiopia proved temporary, and Abu Bakr's family returned to Mecca within a few years, whereas Aisha was then betrothed to Muhammad. Aisha was six when she was betrothed to Muhammad. She stayed at her parents' home until the age of nine when the marriage was consummated. The marriage was delayed until after the Hijra, or migration to Medina, in 622. Aisha and her older sister, Asma bint Abi Bakr, only moved to Medina after Muhammad had already fled there. Abu Bakr gave Muhammad the money to build a house for himself. After this, the wedding was celebrated very simply. After the wedding, Aisha continued to play with her toys, and Muhammad entered into the spirit of these games. What's her status as a favorite wife? Well, even though the marriage may have been politically motivated, and of course, we figured that one out, to mark the ties between Muhammad and his companion, Abu Bakr, most early accounts say that Muhammad and Aisha became sincerely fond of each other. Aisha is usually described as Muhammad's favorite wife, as I mentioned, and it was in her company that Muhammad reportedly received the most revelations. Now remember, this was his third wife. The first wife he was married to, she was much older. Muhammad married her when he was in his 20s. She was in her 40s. She was a caravan operator. And, well, we know what happened. Muhammad turned into a robber thief. And there are accusations of adultery. There was an incident in which Aisha was traveling with her husband, Muhammad. And, well, let's put it this way. Oh, sorry about that. I just had to hit my cough button. Let's put it this way. Yeah, there were rumors flying about, and we know Muhammad is a very suspicious man. When Aisha was traveling with her husband Muhammad and some of his followers, Aisha claimed that she had left camp in the morning to search for her lost necklace. But when she returned, she found that the company had broken camp and left without her. She waited for half a day until she was rescued by a man named Safwan ibn al-Mittal and taken to rejoin the caravan. Now, this led to speculation that she had committed adultery with Safwan. Muhammad's adopted son, Zayd ibn Haritha, defended Aisha's reputation, and shortly after this, Muhammad announced that he had received a revelation confirming Aisha's innocence and directing that charges of adultery be supported by four eyewitnesses. So there you go, one of Muhammad's revelations. These verses also rebuked Aisha's accusers, who Muhammad ordered to receive 40 lashes, among them his poet Hassan ibn Thibat. So can you see where these hadiths are coming from? Muhammad was so deeply in love with Aisha and these charges of adultery that this was his revelation and four eyewitnesses would be needed to prove rape or adultery. But we know that those four eyewitnesses, they have to be men, because we know the word of one man is worth that of four women within the auspices of Islam. There is an interesting story here about the honey. Ibn Kathir wrote in his biography of Muhammad that Muhammad's wife, Salama Hind bint Abi Yuma'ah, was given a skin filled with honey, which she shared with her husband. He stayed overlong with Salama Hind bint Abi Ima, at least in the opinion of Aisha and her co-wife, Hafsa bin Umar. Aisha and Hafsa conspired. Each of them was to tell Muhammad that the honey had given him bad breath. When he heard this from the two wives, he believed that it was true and swore that he would eat no more of the honey. Soon afterwards, he reported that he had received a revelation in which he was told that he could eat anything permitted by God. In the following verses, Muhammad's wives are rebuked for their unruliness. Your hearts are not inclined to oppose him. So he was not happy with the two wives there. Word spread in the small Muslim community that Muhammad's wives were tyrannized. They were tyrannizing him. Yeah, they were setting upon him. And word spread in the community. They were speaking sharply to him and conspiring against him. Umar, Hafsa's father, scolded his daughter and also spoke to Muhammad of the matter. Muhammad, saddened and upset, separated from his wives for a month. By the end of this time, his wives were humbled and harmony was restored. Now, when Muslim commentators on the Quran explicate Al-Tirim, Surah 6, it is usually this story that is told to explain the occasion of revelation. There is a similar but alternative explanation of this chapter also involving Aisha. In this story, Aisha and her co-wives were unhappy because Muhammad was infatuated with Maria al-Qutba, the Coptic Christian woman who bore Muhammad a brief-lived son. Some accounts say she was a slave. Some say that she converted to Islam, was freed, and was taken as a wife. And you will not believe this. I am losing my chat room. So my apologies for that. So I'm just going to have to reboot that. Now, this is interesting. Muhammad was quite into the ladies, as we have figured out at this point. Uh-oh. And I don't know if you can hear this, but we have rolling thunderstorms going on. So if I drop off all of a sudden, it's because the power went out. So if that happens, my apologies. But yeah, Aisha and the co-wives, they were unhappy because Muhammad was infatuated with Maria L. Oh, here come these fake names again. Katia, and she was a Coptic Christian, like I mentioned. She produced Muhammad with a son that lived briefly. She was probably a slave, but some say that she converted to Islam and was freed and was taken as the wife. And my chat page won't load. So my apologies to everybody for this disruption. This is very bothersome. I've been having issues not only with Blog Talk Radio, but with my server, Rogers Cable. I will try to carry forth the best I can. And I'm sorry, I cannot see the chat room right now. Now, the death of Muhammad, Ibn Ishkas, in his Sirah Rasul Allah, states that during Muhammad's last illness, he saw Aisha's apartments and died with his head in her lap. The Sunni take this as evidence that Muhammad's fondness for Aisha was genuine. The Shia deny this and say that Muhammad died with his head in Ali's lap. Now, Aisha never remarried after Muhammad's death. A passage in the Quran forbids any Muslim to marry a widow of Muhammad. Here is the quote. Nor is it right for you that ye should annoy God's apostle, or that ye should marry his widows after him at any time. Truly such a thing in God's sight is an enormity. And that is Quran chapter 33, verse 53. Still can't get my chat room back. As a matter of fact, I'm losing everything. My entire pages have frozen up. But that's all right. I'm still around. Now, after Muhammad, Aisha's father becomes the first caliph. After Muhammad's death in 632 AD, Aisha's father, Abu Bakr, became the first caliph or leader of the Muslims. Now, this matter of succession to Muhammad is extremely controversial to the Sharias. My apologies. Shia believes that Ali had been chosen to lead by Muhammad. Sunni maintains that the community chose Abu Bakr and did so in accordance with Muhammad's wishes. This led into the Battle of Basra. Abu Bakr's reign was short, and in 634 AD, he was succeeded by Umar as the caliph. Umar reigned for 10 years and was then followed by Uthman ibn Affan in 644 AD. Both of these men had been among Muhammad's earliest followers. They were linked to him by clanship and marriage and had taken prominent parts in various military campaigns. Aisha, in the meantime, lived in Medina and made several pilgrimages to Mecca. In 656, Uthman was killed by rebellious Muslim soldiers. The rebels then ask Ali to be the new caliph. Many reports absolve Ali of complicity in the murder. He is reported to have refused the caliphate. He agreed by rule, and only to rule, only after his followers persisted. Aisha raised an army which confronted Ali's army outside the city of Basra. Professor Lilia Ahmed claims that it was during this engagement that Muslims slaughtered Muslim upon Muslim for the first time. Battle ensued, and Aisha's forces were defeated. Aisha was directing her forces from a howdah on the back of a camel. This 656 battle is therefore called the Battle of the Camel. Ali captured Aisha but declined to harm her. He sent her back to Medina under military escort. She lived a retired life until she died approximately 678 under the reign of Muawiyah the First. Now there are Sunni and Shia views of Aisha. Sunni historians see Aisha as a learned woman who tirelessly recounted stories from the life of Muhammad and explained Muslim history and traditions. She is considered to be one of the foremost scholars of Islam's early age, and some historians accrediting up to one quarter of the Islamic Sharia, which is Islamic religious law, based on the collection of the hadiths, to have stemmed from her narrations. Aisha became the most prominent of Muhammad's wives and is also revered as a role model by millions of women. Shia historians believe that Ali should have been the first caliph and that the other three caliphs were usurpers. Aisha not only supported Umar, Uthman, and her father Abu Bakr, she also raised an army and fought against Ali, her stepson-in-law. Shia believes that she did wrong in rebelling against Ali. So I hope that explains a few things there. There are some advanced information that we can go into. I am going to look for, I did have a clip here I wanted to play. And let me see if I can bring it up. I'm having technical difficulties. We're having absolute terrible thunderstorms right now. I have lost my chat room. And so what I'm going to do is, I want to play this for you, and this is the, hang on, sorry guys. And, you know, it's hard when your page is shut down and everything shuts down. It's not only Blog Talk Radio, it's also your server and stuff. But it's frustrating, and it really throws you off your game. But we were discussing the issue of Aisha as inspired by Bigfoot and his query yesterday on the, on Islam Exposed. We have determined that Aisha was a warrior in her own right. She opposed the accession ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining Red Fox Blogger. See you next week. No, I'm kidding. Aisha had a lot of opinions about the accession after Muhammad died. That is how the Sunni and the Shia came about to come about into disrepute. Now, she was quite the something, though. She was very fond of Muhammad. Muhammad, of course, she was the third wife. She was the favorite wife. Now, this is something that Aisha narrated herself. The Prophet engaged me when I was a girl of 6 years. We went to Medina and stayed at the home of Bani al-Harith bin Karzad. Then I got ill and my hair fell down, which means her hair fell out. Later on, my hair grew again, and my mother, Rumman, came to me while I was playing in a swing with some of my girlfriends. She called me, and I went to her, not knowing what she wanted to do with me. She caught me by the hand and made me stand at the door of the house. I was breathless then, and when my breathing became all right, she took some water and rubbed my face and head with it. Then she took me into the house. There in the house, I saw some Ansari woman who said, best wishes and Allah's blessings and good luck. Then she entrusted me to them, and they prepared me for marriage. Unexpectedly, Allah's apostle came to me in the forenoon, and my mother handed me over to him, and at that time I was a girl of 9 years of age. That is from the Hadith, Volume 5, Book 58, Number 234. This comes from the Sahih Al-Bukhari, Hadith, Volume 8, Book 73, Number 151. This is narrated by Aisha. I used to play with the dolls in the presence of the Prophet, and my girlfriends also used to play with me. When Allah's apostle used to enter my dwelling place, they used to hide themselves, but the Prophet would call them to join and play with me. The playing with the dolls and similar images is forbidden, but it was allowed for Aisha at the time, as she was a little girl, not yet reached the age of puberty. That is from Fatah al-Bari, page 143, volume 13. This is from the book Sahih Muslim, book 8, number 3309, and chapter 10. It is permissible for the father to get the hand of his daughter in marriage even when she is not fully grown up. Aisha, Allah be pleased with her, reported. Once again, words from Aisha. Allah's messenger, may peace be upon him, married me when I was 6 years old, and I was admitted to his house at the age of 9. She further went on to say, we went to Medina, and I had an attack of fever for a month, and my hair had come down to the earlobe. It fell out. She was actually gray by the time she turned 18, but hey. Rumman, who was Aisha's mother, my mother, came to me, and I was at that time on a swing along with my playmates. She called me loudly, and I went to her, and I did not know what she wanted of me. And we know what she ended up doing. She ended up marrying Muhammad. Salah, Muslim, Book 8, Number 3310. Aisha reported, Allah's apostate took me upon him. There are so many passages in here. This is probably not the best link I could use because there's a lot of repeating in here and a lot of English interpretation. But I think we're getting a pretty good idea of who Aisha is. She was a warrior, or warrioress, if you like. She opposed the accession of Shia to rule after Muhammad's death. She fought hard to ensure the Sunni accession. But the thing is that she was very wise for a Muslim. She was a very wise woman. She led armies. And she was very, very, very forthright in how she thought the accession should go. She was very displeased with it. I blame Muhammad. He did not leave a will. He did not leave a will of accession. And thus, to this day, we have the Shia and the Sunni going back and forth, and they're killing each other. More Sunnis and Shia fall at the hands at their own selves than Christians, Jews, Buddhists, monks, anything that you can imagine. There has always been the internal battles as to who is the actual successor to the false prophet, Muhammad. We have to remember, this person was 50-plus years old when he married a child of six and cohabited with her when she was 9 years old. Now, as quoted above, okay, the most trusted collections of the Hadith established the authenticity of this oral tradition. But still, Western Muslims are embarrassed by these Hadiths. Sometimes they use a weak Hadith, and that is a defense to excuse Muhammad's child marriage. Well, how can we? Your prophet was a pedophile. And, of course, I am directly quoting Gadi Edelman over that one. But I shouldn't utter other people's names in this show because it has been causing me grief all evening. Now, at other times, what Mohammedans do, they use an Arabic culture defense by claiming that no one has the right to judge Oriental culture by Occidental norms. Now, okay, that's craziness. That's just crazy talk. This is a strange defense, guys, and it's really strange to make since Muslims frequently criticize Western cultures as being morally decadent. Okay, now who's calling the kettle black? Hello! If another culture cannot be morally evaluated, then other cultures must not be judged as morally decadent. Good point. But this conclusion is not acceptable to Muslims since they argue that an Islamic culture is the better culture. And that's right. We are the Dar al-Harb, al-Harb. They are the Dar al-Islam. So we must conclude that cultures may be evaluated morally or that someone is hypocritically judging others while not permitting themselves to be judged by the same standard. However, if hypocrisy is not a good alternative, then it is concluded that cultures may be evaluated morally. Hello? Hello? Yes. In fact, it is permissible and even desirable to have moral discussions on cultural issues. Moral discussions on cultural issues occur in many different cultures. And Annie of Southern Sense, you bring up a very good point in the chat room. So if a Chinese American is elected president, then he doesn't have to follow American traditions and morals? Bingo! And this is what the Mohammedans feel, is that they want the status of being an equal culture, but they do not want to be judged morally. So the problem of Muhammad marrying a child cannot be defended on Eastern cultural grounds. This issue remains as to whether or not Muhammad acted rightly in marrying a six-year-old, Certainly it is wrong, according to the natural order of Allah's creation. In fact, many nations of the world list such behavior as a crime against nature, and it is. It's pedophilia. Gee, you know? You know, how much more do I have to say here? So it must be concluded that Muhammad committed a great moral sin against the moral order of Allah's creation. Now that's an interesting one. I like that. And his behavior is reprehensible. It's a reprehensible example for others to follow. It is tragic to read news reports of old men marrying children in some Islamic countries because they seek to follow the example of Muhammad, who married a child. Muhammad had such an interest in fondling young girls. He criticized even the lawful marriage union of two grown adults. That is true. He did not penetrate Aisha until she started to menstruate at the age of 9, but he engaged in thawing. And there are other reports that Aisha would have to take his robes and wash them and scrub them to get his semen stains off of them. That started at the age of 6. Let you absorb that one. Now, this is from Sahih al-Bukhari. This is volume 7, book 62, number 17. This is narrated by Jabir bin Abdullah. When I got married, Allah's Apostle said to me, "What type of lady have you married?" I replied, "I have married a matron." He said, "Why don't you have a liking for the virgins and for fondling them?" Jabir also said, "Allah's Apostle said, why don't you marry a young girl so that you might play with her and she with you?" See, the guy was a pedophile. He was just damned crazy. Well, you know what? He was a good Muslim. We have Sahih al-Bukhari, volume 7, book 62, number 17, like I say. You need proof. You need proof. And it's all there. You do not have to conjecture. It's all there. It's all in writing. I have a closing out I'm going to do, but I'm at the top of the hour, and I really do need to take a break. And after that, Michael Green will be joining me. It's been quite the wiggy show, tech issues and all that. Glad you guys are sticking with me. I love you all. But I have a song here I want to play. And every once in a while, somebody will send me a song and say, "What do you think about this for the show?" And I'll think to myself, I don't know. But Vorp sent this to me, and I thought, this is just too funny not to play. It's beautiful. It's called Bargain Shop Panties. And it's probably quite appropriate because we are, after all, talking about pedophiles. But let's take a listen to this. I'll see you guys back here in 3 minutes. And thank you, Vorp.
Bargain shop. Set up in a quad. Set off a main street half a block. They got bargain shop.
want to thank for that. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Red Fox Blogger. I'm your host, Kel Fritzy, and we are discussing Aisha. Michael Green will be joining me shortly, and we will be discussing issues out of the Middle East. Michael has a story he wants to share with you, but I am so grateful that you guys are sticking this train wreck out. A12 Iggy Mom, Bigfoot, COG, Doc, Jeff of English Defense League, my guests, Hold Your Awakens, Lady Michelle, Diane, that is Property, Southern Sense is Common Sense, that is my Annie, and Vorpalbite, you guys are the best. And, of course, Moving Forward, who joined me on the air earlier. Now, while I'm waiting for Michael to call in, I am going to just close this out. It won't take long because it is very important to understand exactly what this is all about. Aisha and Muhammad, a love story? I think not. You know, Muhammad married a child at 6 years old. He is considered the perfect man. I find this absolutely shocking that Muhammadans still follow this to this day. We have heard the stories about the traveling Ayatollahs and how they consummate with the pubescent daughter, a nubile daughter, in which he is a guest, and the parents are so proud despite hearing the screams in the next room. Ladies, this was in the 20th century. We see this all the time. We saw that Muhammad had an interest in a baby crawling before him, and he said, if she grows up and I am still alive, I will marry her. Fortunately, he died before she grew up. So Muhammad's interest in young girls extended beyond Aisha. Now, who would anyone think that Muhammad's sexual interest in babies be the timeless expression of the will of Allah? Please, ask yourself that. How does such a pure desire support Muhammad's claim to be a prophet of Allah? Such a desire by an old man is contrary to nature, and it is a perversion against the moral order of Allah's universe. And this is according to the naysayers, the apologists, but it's in the Quran, it's there. But according to Islam, Muhammad is the perfection of humanity and the prototype of the most wonderful human conduct. He married a 9-year-old and leaves an enduring legacy for old Muslim men to fulfill their carnal desires contrary to the natural law into the lifelong devastation of young girls. Now, what is the modern effect of Muhammad and Aisha? Many Muslim countries consider only men to be important, where women are not allowed to go to school, to drive, to work, or even to talk to any other adult men who is not a relative. Now, we are aware of a specific situation in Saudi Arabia, where a judge decided that he could not annul a marriage in 2008, and this was between a 58-year-old man and an 8-year-old girl. Sadly, that is not an unusual situation, as the girls and their parents have virtually no rights against a man who claims to be the husband and therefore owner of any woman or girl. Many Muslim countries officially declare that the age of consent of a girl is generally around 12 to 13 years of age, but local tribal jurisdiction often overrides any national guideline on this, and wives, quote unquote, who are 7 or 8 or 9 years old, that is not uncommon. And like the Saudi Arabia court case, the man is accepted as husband. The girl virtually never has any rights at all. This seems to be to extend to life and death, where a man with several wives apparently does not even need to present any cause to murder one or more of his wives, i.e. honor killing. It seems more common that they decide to keep them as wives, but to throw battery acid in their faces to make the girl woman so ugly that no man will ever want to even talk to her. Many people have tried to find ways of helping such girls and women over such decades, but the tribal authority in many Muslim countries is considered to be of religious basis, thereby automatically superseding any governmental authority. It is hard to see how such girls and women are ever likely to have any rights at all. And ladies and gentlemen, that is your Sharia. I know we had quite a few hiccups technically wise. I do hope that you did gloss something out of that, though. I hope that I explained to you exactly what is going on in terms of women's rights within Islam. And I think Aisha explained it quite nicely in her own words, and this article explained it with their fact-filled quotes. The hadiths are all there. I'll put the link in the chat room in a moment. Like I say, this article was very, very comprehensive, but there's a few repeats in it. But that's okay. That's okay. I think I managed to get through it. And I hope that you could follow the bouncing ball, despite the fact that I was getting kicked in and out of my own show. But you know what? I want to thank you for paying attention to the first hour. It's very important. And, of course, I offer my apologies for Ned. But with that, we are in the second hour, and I would like to bring on Michael Green, who is joining me this evening. And, Michael, how are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great, Kel, and yourself?
Had a few tech issues, but getting through it.
Good. Glad to hear that.
So what has been going on with you? You have quite a few things that you need to relate. I'm going to sit back and pass the mic to you and let you go right ahead.
Well, I want to pick it up with a few recent developments in Iraq. Everyone knows about the beheading of Stephen Sotloff, so I don't want to get into too much detail about that.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, there's a lot of so-called important world leaders meeting at a NATO summit discussing what to do with this group of savage barbarians. And I'm not too optimistic about the outcome of that meeting, which I'll get to in a minute. But first, the United States conducted some airstrikes in Iraq, and it took out three leaders of the Islamic State, one who is a close aide to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, their Khalifa. So this one individual, Abu Hajar al-Sufif, who is part of Baghdadi's inner circle, is reportedly killed in a U.S. airstrike in an area called Tal Afar. It's part of Mosul in northwestern Iraq. So he collected his 72 virgin goats. Good riddance. Now we've got two other Islamic State operatives, more or less military commanders, who also got to get martyred and collect some virgin goats. I believe those goats are actually male. It's undetermined whether those goats are male or female. I say they're male, but who knows, but those who are partaking of that, I don't think they'll be returning to tell us. I'm trying to interject a little humor. I got to tell you, I watched the video tonight produced by the New York Times, and to think I'd watch anything produced by the New York Times, I'm just trying to catch myself. Did I actually go to the New York Times website? Yes, I did. One thing I have to give them credit, and you can never credit the New York Times for anything but being a bunch of leftist scumbags, they produced a short documentary of the only survivor of a massacre of Iraqi Shiite soldiers. You know, this took place way back when we saw just columns and columns of these young men being marched to their death, and then they were summarily shot in the head. But it was a very riveting and powerful piece that the New York Times did, and it was this young soldier, and he was interviewed, and they actually had him watching video of this horrific execution, different, you know, video segments which the Islamic State fighters videotaped. And it was quite compelling. One thing I found extraordinary was his ability to sit and watch that footage, because those were all his fellow soldiers and people that he got to know somewhat. He was a young recruit. Many young Iraqis were recruited in June when the Islamic State, back then formerly ISIS, went on their warp footing and, of course, started to make great gains. And the base was overrun, and you just had these guys, and they weren't seasoned fighters by any means. They were just a bunch of young recruits who were willing to take up arms and fight for their country. So the Islamic State fighters overran the base, captured them, and just slaughtered them in cold blood. So the New York Times did something good for once. They focused on that terrible atrocity, and they showed the this man, this young Iraqi soldier, who it is absolutely miraculous that he survived and what he had to go through. I'd encourage anybody listening or in the chat room, go online, Google it, and you can find the video, Iraqi Soldier Survives Massacre, New York Times. That's your keyword search, and you'll find it. Watch this thing. It's very important. It just reconfirms the absolute necessity that the West needs to wake up. Yeah.
You're referring to the 700 Iraqi soldiers, aren't you?
Well, actually, no. It was estimated 1,500. The number
estimated 1,500, really?
1,500 initially when the Islamic State started taking ground in Iraq. This is back in June. The offensive began, I believe, somewhere around June 8th. And that's when they were able to take Mosul and Tikrit and just, you know, they were already in Fallujah and Ramadi. They got into Fallujah and Ramadi somewhere around January and February. And then Al Anbar province, but this is the one slaughter, the well-known one, that was pretty publicized back around June and July, and this young Iraqi Shiite soldier, So it's a very compelling and powerful video, not too long and well worth watching.
I have been watching a couple of videos. I can't anymore because it's just it's like a repeat nightmare. But this is a culmination that's been going on since the IS came into being. And but Southern Sense brought up a really good point in the chat room, and I'd like to expand on this, Michael. Is that were there actually 700 alone this week?
Yeah, now those were Syrian soldiers, if I'm correct, or some of them. There was a massacre of about 250 Syrian soldiers who were captured when the Islamic State overran a important Syrian military base. And they captured about 250 Syrian soldiers, and they marched them to their death. Some of them they slit their throats, and others they shot them. And there are
they were burying some alive. They were throwing them in mass graves, and then they were they were also dumping others in rivers.
Yeah, sure. They did that back in June in the massacre I'm referring to from the New York Times video. Exactly. They would put them by a river, and then shoot them in the back of the head, and the body would fall forward, and of course, go into the river. The reason I say people should watch it, and it's not for the graphic footage of people being shot and killed, but to see this young man and, you know, how he speaks about this atrocity, that once again it's miraculous that he survives. He's the only survivor. And just to watch his emotions and see it, it just brings it home and gives it, I think, a stronger sense in terms of a human connection, because he did survive this, he lived through it, and he's being filmed watching on a laptop computer some of this graphic footage and explaining what happened.
You had to view this, and What do you suppose we're to do about this? I don't know what the Obama administration is doing. I don't know what the Cameron administration is doing about this, nor do I know what the Harper administration is going to do about this. But they all come out and they stand around the microphones and they condemn it. But Obama came out today, in fact, and he said, we're not going to be intimidated by the slaughter of American journalists. Now, there's a third American journalist that Islamic State has said that they have up for beheading. And I don't know if they're going to do it this week. I'm sure they will. But this is how they are trying to control us, through graphics and fear. They put them up on YouTube. YouTube removes them as fast as they possibly can, but they still get out there, and people watch it. If you get a video, for example, from Islamic State, it's probably got already, 1,500 hits before YouTube can finally remove it.
Look, YouTube does a crummy job in taking this stuff down. I got to tell you, I've done a lot of research, and at the outset, when something's released, if it's a well-known beheading, which means it's one of these journalists, there are two of them, James Foley and then Stephen Sotloff, yeah, they'll go and try to look for it. But YouTube is so vast and massive, and YouTube doesn't have the apparatus in place, nor do they have the staff, because they don't care, to try to police and remove this stuff. And there's plenty of other beheading videos and other videos of Islamic State savagery at YouTube. So it's something that, once again, is not being addressed, nor will it be, unfortunately. These videos are recruiting tools. The Islamic State uses these videos to recruit those that they can reach through the Internet to join their campaign of slaughter of infidels. And as horrific as it is, it actually works, because this generation is a lost generation. And violence is something that has become kind of the in thing. And all this technology that allows people to view this this evil, because that's what it is, it's pure evil, resonates within certain individuals because they're desensitized to it. And, you know, it's all part of the very well put together campaign that the Islamic State's running on social media. I want to jump into that in a minute, because there's an American who is the one of the top people in running the Islamic State's social media program. But I just want to finish up the other point. So a couple of these ISIS individuals are dead, and this is an airstrike from the United States done in this area near Mosul. So what's going on here is the U.S. is doing very, very little, and they took out a couple of people who are up there in the chain of command, so it looks good and it sounds good. It gets press coverage for people who are like low-information people. They don't understand the magnitude and the entirety of this situation. They'll think, hey, gee, that's great. Wow, the U.S. is really doing a good job. That's a lot of garbage. It's nonsense. These three people have probably already been replaced. You know, killing a couple of people within an organization that has a massive command structure and a massive number of fighters, and they're recruiting constantly, that we'll get to that in the social media aspect, it's meaningless. So Obama and Cameron are over at this big summit, and they want to turn this thing over to NATO. They want to make this into a NATO coalition. You know what's going to happen? It's going to fail. I'm going to tell you why. NATO went into Afghanistan, and there's a big coalition that was formed, more so than with Bush, with Obama, because Obama extended the war in 2009. He deployed 34,000 American combat ground troops, and he put NATO right in the mix. The people that are in the NATO command structure, these generals, are a bunch of idiots. They're politically correct. They don't understand war and what you really have to do, and you can't have rules of engagement that restrict your fighters. And you have to use certain tactics and things that just aren't popular within the multiculturalist political spheres today. So I've been following this the past 2 days about how Obama and Cameron are trying to build this coalition with several other countries who are members of NATO. Now, the thing is, it's going to take time to build that coalition. Then you have to put together the command structure. Then you have to determine your tactics on the battlefield, and it's an involved thing. And by the time that thing gets off the ground, well, ISIS will probably be taking more territory. So it's not encouraging at all. I find it to be very irritating, but typical. John Kerry actually said that, well, it could take a year, it could take 2 years, it might even take 3 years. That's a good message to send to our enemies. Let them know that this could be a long, drawn-out thing, and it could be years and years. Bad move. That's not what you want to let your enemy know. You want to let them know you're coming for them, and you're coming soon, and you're going to utterly decimate them. You're going to kill the bastards and as many of them as you can.
I have a question for you, and this was brought up on another radio program. This was a very interesting question that someone posed. President Obama came on, and he said that he has no idea what to do with what's going on. And actually, it was Agador that brought this up, and we played this on the show today. I'm going to play this for you, and I want you to give me a thought on what you think about this clip. I'll play it for you right now, Michael. Oopsie. Wrong clip. Here we are.
Breaking tonight, growing concern about the unchecked threat from the world's most dangerous terror group, as the president came out late today and admitted, and I quote, "We don't have a strategy for dealing with these barbarians." Welcome to the Kelly File, everyone. I'm Megyn Kelly. For 4 years now, members of the military and intelligence communities have been watching an Al-Qaeda offshoot now known as ISIS. They warned the administration with increasing alarm over the last 12 months as the terrorist army gathered fighters, money, and equipment and launched a horrific and bloody campaign to capture a portion of Iraq and Syria that is now the size of Belgium. This broadcast covered extensively how ISIS took over the cities of Fallujah and Mosul in reports going back to last January. Then, 10 days ago, the world watched in horror as this group beheaded American journalist James Foley and threatened to decapitate another American hostage in its custody. Here is Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel just 48 hours later.
ISIL is as sophisticated and well-funded as any group that we have seen. They're beyond just a terrorist group. They marry ideology, a sophistication of strategic and tactical military prowess. They are tremendously well-funded. Oh, this is beyond anything that we've seen. So we must prepare for everything.
Beyond anything. Prepare for everything. Want more? Here's Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Rogers, on this broadcast last night.
Our fear here is that this notion that if we just don't do anything, everything is going to be okay, is going to continue. This is as dangerous a threat matrix as I have ever seen in my time on the Intel Committee, which is about 10 years, Megyn. It is serious.
Then today, as a reminder of who these guys are, we received this video of Syrian soldiers, 250 of them reportedly, captured by ISIS, stripped to their underwear, marched through the desert by their laughing captors, then shot dead and left in a scene we will not show you. Yesterday, the White House assured the public the president has a, quote, comprehensive strategy for dealing with this group. So when word broke today that the president was in the Situation Room and would later make an announcement, it sounded like that strategy might soon be revealed. The president came to the lectern and talked about the economy, the holiday weekend. And when he got around to the terror group ISIS, the president admitted that contrary to yesterday's claim from the White House, he does not yet have a strategy for dealing with this problem. Listen.
I don't want to put the cart before the horse. We don't have a strategy yet. I think what I've seen in some of the news reports suggests that folks are getting a little further ahead of where we're at than we currently are.
My God. I think I would rather have replayed the bargain shop panties. Michael. My goodness. And the point that Agador brought up on Islam Exposed was that when we have an enemy or even a ally, we keep an eye out and we get into the war room and we say, we have to deal with this, and they come up with a strategy. Obama went public and said that he doesn't know what the hell he's going to do. Michael?
Yeah, you got to understand. I mean, the thing is to understand or try to understand what motivates this man. There's different facets to this. Number one, more than likely he's a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He is very pro-Islam. He's pro-Islamist, you know, the Islamist movement, which is the jihadist movement. He ran in 2008 on a platform that he was going to end the war in Iraq. And it was a big kind of selling point to the leftist idiots in America that don't understand war, they don't understand the region, and they don't understand that withdrawing American forces precipitously will leave a vacuum. George Bush predicted that in the event America was to leave Iraq in the manner we did in 2011, what would return would be worse. There's actually a video clip of President Bush saying that. So now you have elections in America. You have midterm elections. They're very important. They involve the House of Representatives, which the Republicans currently control, and the Senate, which the Democrats control. Obama's playing politics. He doesn't want to seem too gung-ho because, remember, he determined that we need to end this war. We need to get American military personnel out of Iraq and just walk away from Iraq, and that's what we did. We walked away from it, and we know what walked in, what we're facing now. So I think a part of his motivation on how he's handling this is connected to the upcoming elections and politics. Another part you could probably attribute to the fact that he is an Islamist. He also is very anti-Israel. And, of course, if the Islamic State was to take more territory in the Middle East and become stronger and stronger, it could pose a very serious threat to Israel. And then you could throw in the end that he's a gutless coward. So if you put that all together, you have a very bad combination of someone who really has no interest in bringing the fight to the enemy. You know, you look how he handled the war in Afghanistan. He set our people over there, he tied their hands, you know, he put them out on the battlefield, and, you know, a lot of our people got torn up due to the rules of engagement. Then he started bringing our troops back, taking them out of key locations, like the Marine Corps fort in Helmand Province, paid with a lot of blood to secure that area, push out the Taliban. Taliban are coming back in there now. You know, so if you evaluate him overall, of course, he has no conception or understanding of military tactics and what you need to do. And he doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, he's the president. That's why we have people in the Pentagon who are professional warriors. But he's not interested in deferring to their expertise in terms of advice and say, Mr. President, we need to have a couple of carrier strike force groups in the Gulf, not just one. We only have one right now. We need to have a few. Mm-hmm. We need Marines, okay? We need Marines on those ships, and that's what they do. They go in, and they're ready when it's time to send them in, when it's determined. The American forces on the ground in Iraq now, and it numbers somewhere over 1,000, are not doing anything. They're not fighting. They're basically on bases, and, you know, they can't get out the gate. They're not engaging the enemy. We have people in the north working with the Kurds, training them, the laser targets and everything for airstrikes, and that's all good. But, you know, to make it sound like we have boots on the ground, well, we don't really, because they're not really doing much of anything. Our special ops teams are not engaging the enemy, and that's what those guys are trained to do. They're trained to kill the bastards, and they're good at it. So it's kind of like, you know, Afghanistan, send them in, but don't let them do their job. We have a very serious threat. You know, we all are aware of it. And the way that the United States and these other Western nations are facing this threat is just, it's mind-boggling, and you kind of shake your head and you wonder, you know, do they understand what this group is capable of? I don't think they do. There's about 4,000 fighters at least from Europe over there. We got hundreds from America, many of them passport holders. They are cash rich, this group, Islamic State. They're not a group, they're actually a state.
It doesn't,
you know?
Yeah, it doesn't hurt that they robbed one of the World Banks and that they have so many cash holdings at this point. You're right.
Well, it's beyond that. The oil they've captured, they got 60% of the oil in Syria. They got oil from Iraq. They're taking in anywhere from $1 million to $2 million a day in revenue from oil on the black market. So they're very liquid. They got plenty of cash coming in. They are recruiting a storm of, you know, getting more and more fighters. You know, it's an interesting point. Turkey is a member of NATO, and Turkey is the transit point for these jihadist recruits to go country hopping and, you know, get to Turkey, and then from Turkey enter Syria, and then, of course, go into Iraq if they do that, or they stay in Syria with Islamic State. So the idea that Turkey is part of NATO, you know, so I could just see planning a NATO operation, and Turkey gets privy to the information, and then, you know, how are you going to trust the Turks when they more or less allow the Islamic State?
Well, Is the Prime Minister of Turkey still Recep Tayyip Erdogan?
No, he is the president. I don't understand their political system. He has a lot of influence in that country. Look, Turkey is becoming a Muslim fascist nation. It's no means a moderate Muslim country. More important, that the Islamic State has people on the ground in Turkey recruiting.
Yeah.
And the Turkish government has done very little to attempt to stop their country from being used as the transit point for these people, because that's where they're going. They're going to Turkey.
And that's exactly it. I was doing a report. I was actually speaking with Jeff Mitchell of English Defense League about this, and, of course, Tim Burton, who hail from the U.K., and I was asking both of them. I said, it turns out that the UK has the highest rate of exportation of those going to join the Islamic State to fight. And Jeff and Tim, they brought up both of them almost simultaneously. I mean, they said that, well, what's happening is that Turkey is pretty much a destination point for holiday. And what they're doing, and you're right when you bring up the issue of the passport, yes, they have legitimate passport. And what they're doing is that they're going to Turkey, and hey, I'm going to Turkey, I'm going to enjoy the beaches, whatever, and then they're going through Turkey to get to Syria and Iraq. And they're there, they're fighting the jihad, and then they slither back up into Turkey, and they come back, and their passport is stamped, only went to Turkey.
Well, Turkey's been complicit in the exponential growth of ISIS, and they're the country that's used to enter into Syria, and, of course, Syria and then Iraq. The idea they're part of NATO is frightening, and the whole strategy, the whole way this thing's being approached, it's wrong. And, you know, my prediction is it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. And you have to be willing at some point to send boots on the ground. If anyone knows anything about war and military tactics, you cannot defeat an enemy with air strikes alone. It is impossible. You can hurt them. You can do damage to them, but you cannot defeat them. And what needs to be done is the Islamic State must be defeated, completely, utterly defeated, not contained, not kind of put on the back foot and, you know, push them back. You have to wipe them out. It's like a malignant cancer that's in your body, And if you don't kill that entire cancer, if you leave one piece of it, then it's going to spread. It's going to go throughout your bloodstream, and it's going to attach and metastasize to another one of your vital organs, and one day you're going to wind up dead. So that's what we're dealing with here. And, you know, it's interesting. The nation of Israel has been at war for 60 years, you know.
Oh, yeah.
People who say they're war-weary are not the warriors. You know, I have plenty of guys I know who would love to go over there and kill these bastards, you know, because, hey, that's what soldiers who are in the infantry are trained to do. That's what Marines are trained to do. That's what special ops people like Navy SEALs, Special Forces, whatever branch of the military, that's what they're trained to do. They're trained to kill human beings, to kill the enemy, neutralize the threat, thereby protecting the, you know, threat to our country or Canada, whoever, every Western nation has a military, you know. Nobody wants to use the military anymore, but Islamic State has declared war on us. They've declared war on the U.S., on Canada, on the U.K. You know, pick any Western nation. They've declared war. They drew a line in the sand, and they said, you know what, we're coming for you. We're going to cut your heads off. We're going to drown you in your own blood. And they proved it already. So if the West doesn't wake up and get on the war footing and do what needs to be done to get rid of this cancer, it's going to be a catastrophe. And there's going to be, I would say, terrorist attacks throughout Western nations, inevitably.
What do you think is going to happen this September 11th? Do you... I have two questions for you, but I want to ask this one first. The second question I want to ask is if you think that Barack Hussein Obama actually has a card up his sleeve and that he's just taking a fall right now. But do you think that we can anticipate any global terrorism in light of September 11th coming up in 6 days?
There's intel out now that the Islamic State is planning some type of potential attack to commemorate the 13th anniversary of 9/11, and Al-Qaeda also, Al-Qaeda being separate from the Islamic State. So I'm sure that Western nations are going to be on high alert. Whether they could do anything to interdict this potential threat, you know, stop it from happening, it's hard to say. The Islamic State is mad now. You know, we just killed three of their top people. So they're mad. And they want
they
want to hit
back. Oh, yeah.
You know, which is fine. I mean, hey, that's how it is. But they want to hit back, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen. There's a great possibility that there could be a terrorist attack on that date. Could it be in America? Sure. Could be in another country against the West. I'm sorry, against an American interest. And, you know, it's only today's the 5th, so we got, pardon me, we have 6 days to go before the anniversary.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. But I do want to get into one thing I was trying to talk about earlier. It's about the social media aspect of ISIS. And a man's been identified as a college-educated American citizen whose name is Ahmed Abu Samara. He was born in France, and he was raised in a wealthy area of Boston. His father is actually a prominent endocrinologist at a Massachusetts hospital. So here's this guy. He's very well educated, very computer savvy, and he's working with the Islamic State, and he's one of the key people in their social media department. So you makes you wonder how many other potential Americans with, you know, this type of background are working with them. But as you always hear me speak when I'm on the air, nothing's being done about the war in social media, and that's the jihad war that's being waged in social media, and now, you know, ISIS has, the Islamic State has taken over, amongst other jihadist groups that use this environment to recruit and promote their ideology. So it's just another disturbing development. So, you know, what's Obama going to do? Turn it over to the FBI. What are they going to do? Issue an arrest warrant and go try to arrest this guy? You know.
Exactly. And that leads me into the question.
Well, he's on the FBI's most wanted list. They have a $50,000 reward for the capture of him. No, don't capture these people. Kill them.
Yeah. I was listening to a radio program, and somebody proposed that that clip I played when Obama came on, and he virtually had no idea what he's doing. Somebody very bold put in the chat room that maybe he's taken the fall for now, and that he actually does have a strategy, but he's withholding it from us. And Vorpalbite said in the chat room, "Obama the fool with a card up his sleeve, oh please." And I'm sorry, I have to agree with Vorp. I don't think this guy has a clue.
Well, he doesn't have an interest, you know. So it really begins. Remember.
He's not a stupid man. Yeah, he's not a stupid man. You're right.
ISIS has been building since 3-4 years. There's plenty of reports out now from independent military think tanks and intel sources. You know, we know the deal. They've been around.
Yeah.
They've been building. Our intelligence services certainly have been privy to this. They've been aware of it under Obama's leadership.
Yeah.
They've done nothing. That's a willful act to do nothing. It's a conscious decision that, okay, I'm aware of this. Now, remember, the United States president daily gets intel briefings, and about 100 copies are printed. That's about it. 100 people get it. The president gets it, of course, and other individuals, and he gets this briefing. And no doubt within this briefing, there have been references to this threat over the past number of years. Excuse me. He has ignored it. And whatever has been done is so limited. For example, the Yazidis are not out of danger. They're still in danger,
Are they still stuck on the side of that mountain?
Well, no. The Peshmerga were able to get them off the mountain. Thank God, they opened up a corridor in Islamic State territory, and they were able to get the majority of them out. But by no means are they safe in the sense that we know they need to be safe. But there's a new genocide that's been underway, and it's, thank God, hasn't been completed. There's a town in Iraq called Amirli, and it is home to what are called Turkmen. Turkmen are a Shiite minority. So ISIS has been attempting to overrun this town. They've actually laid siege to it. It's been about 70 days. And the people are in dire straits from lack of food, clean drinking water, and whatnot. A lot of people are becoming ill. They're dying. They're not being killed, you know, by the Islamic State fighters yet. So, you know, if anybody's interested, you can go on the Internet and you can find out about this. But it's not getting a lot of press. But it's another... it's a similar Yazidi-type story. This small town has been blockaded by the Islamic State. So you know what the U.S. has done? It sent in some weapons, very few, and airlifted or dropped some humanitarian supplies. Same with the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government doesn't seem to care about them. I don't know, maybe there's some discriminatory behavior towards them. Who knows? Bottom line is these people are human beings. You know, you got old women there, you got children, and it's like... It's just another horrific example of the savagery of this group. And what does the West do? They sit on their hands, they pontificate, they go hold summits, and they talk about what we're going to do. And, well, it could take 6 months, it could take a year, it could take 2 years, and meanwhile, human beings are going to be slaughtered.
We're wrapping up the show very shortly, but we have some comments from the chat room, Michael. And Matchy brought up a really good point, and so did Lady Michelle, in that Matchy said that he read an article that some food supplies dropped by Air Force, they exploded upon impact and were ruined. And Lady Michelle also reiterated that in saying, as well as the water that has been dropped.
Well, that happened on Mount Sinjar, and that was the first run. And they didn't use parachutes to bring the humanitarian aid down properly. And that's true. That did take place. But the thing is that thank God the Peshmerga were able to get these people off that mountain because, you know, dropping all those supplies it's a joke. What is it going to do? These people, if it wasn't for the Peshmerga, you know, what do? We look, you know, come on. We're talking about the United States. We ran a few airstrikes. We took out a few artillery pieces, and we took out a couple of their vehicles.
Yeah.
Just study the history of war and what really goes on in war and, you know, how you got to deal with the enemy. And, you know, these, like, kind of pinprick limited airstrikes are just the bare minimum to show the world that we're doing something, but it's doing very little.
Absolutely. Michael, we're wrapping up. I want you to take the last few minutes of your valued time and apprise the people what you do, what's going on, and how you're feeling about things. Go right ahead, please. Kind sir.
Well, as many know, I've been a very blessed person to work with scores of badly wounded American service members who have been on the battlefield in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And good news is that we have very few wounded coming in from Afghanistan. Of course, the Iraq war ended a long time ago, but we do have here in America many, many young men and some women still suffering from their wounds, even though the Iraq war ended quite a long time ago. So we never want to forget what people do when they sign on, especially when they go into infantry. You know, there's different things a person can do in the military, but those that choose to go into the infantry are those who are going to wind up on the front lines and expose themselves to harm or death. And if you just sit back and think about what's going on in Iraq and Syria, and you see the slaughter and the lack of protection and safety, the lack of freedom that these people have, it's tragic. So when you wake up every day, really think that you are a very blessed person if you live in the United States or in some other nation where your freedom has been secured by people who have been willing to die for you that never met you. It's really an awesome thing for someone to do that, to go out and put themselves in harm's way, because the freedom we have was paid for. It was fought for, whether it's the U.S. or the U.K. or Canada. War is what secured our freedom, sacrifice, enormous sacrifice, not just the physical wounds of war, but what it does to a human being to be on the battlefield and to see death up close. You know, you see it on a computer screen or a TV, and, you know, we're detached from it. But you see it right in front of you, and it's images that never leave your mind. It haunts a lot of these guys and some women for the rest of their life, especially if they suffer the loss of, you know, their brothers and sisters in arms, and they die, you know, right there in their arms or, you know, shortly thereafter. It's something that I just hope many people become aware of and never forget. Never take for granted your freedom and the things you have in your life that don't put you in a situation like these people who are the Yazidi or others in Iraq or Syria or anywhere in the world where it's a war-ravaged environment.
Yeah.
And from one day to the next, you really don't know, you know, if you're going to be alive or what's going to happen to you or your loved ones.
Michael, I want to thank you so very much once again. Michael Green joins me at the second hour on Friday evenings on Red Fox Blogger. And believe me, we always have something to relate to you. Michael, I want to thank you so very much.
Well, thanks for having me on, and let's keep all these people are suffering in our thoughts and prayers. You know, we don't know who they are, but if you're a human being, it's just got to cut to your heart when you see what war does and savagery perpetrated by Islamic barbarians on especially young children and people like that who are the most innocent of all. You know, they haven't even had a chance to live.
Absolutely.
So. Important.
Absolutely. We had a lot of listeners tonight, and we want to thank everybody that joined us in the chat room. We had Iggy Mom. She's the proprietor of A Halls of Valhalla. Bigfoot, he's the proprietor of Bigfoot's Place. Boris Yeltsin, COG Doc, English Defense League. That is Jeff. He is the proprietor of the English Defense League radio show. We have Eric Kyle, Firefox News Online. I just noticed George Walken. He is the proprietor of Firefox News Online. You can listen to George 7 days a week here on Block Talk Radio. Thank you, guests, for joining us. Golf Dogs, I'm Imam Godas. Okay, Kidney Thief, Lady Michelle, my beautiful Michelle. Machi, Moose Attack, Preparity, and that, I should say that properly. Preparity, that's Diane. I know that's Diane. Rolf Harris, Southern Sense is Common Sense, and that's my Annie Spunky. We have The Wanker, okay. Tony Danza joined us. Totally Gay, Vorpal Bite. Some really cool nicknames going on in here, folks. Thank you, though, for joining us. You took time out of your otherwise busy day to spend with ours, and we also thank people that listen in archive, and we know you do. Listen to what Michael Green conveyed to you tonight, and please try to make sense of my mismatch from the first hour when I had all my tech issues and was totally thrown off my game, but you folks still stayed with me. Oh, and I forgot to mention Holger Awakens, who has his show on Block Talk Radio as well. You guys are the absolute best. On behalf of Michael and myself, we thank you all so very much. And Michael, I will be speaking with you soon. Remember, folks, it is mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity. Have a great week. We'll see you back here where I fly solo the first hour and Michael joins me in the second.
You don't look the same the way you did before. Okay.
also thank you to Moose Attack and Rolf Harris. You guys are the best. Thank you very much for being here. Please join us next week. Have a great weekend.